comment sometime. So what I'd like to do is just to introduce Dr. Shannon Dorsey, who is assistant professor in the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Washington in Seattle. And Dr. Dorsey.
I told Anthony he couldn't steal my story, which was that in 2003, when I've been doing PCIT for about 5 years, a lot of what I do is with kids in foster care, and I do TFCBT with kids in foster care, and I used to do a lot of PCIT with kids in foster care. And I had convinced someone at UC Davis to let me use their PCIT videos, and I got the videos mailed. I've been using them with clients, and I'd watch them over and over. Well, who's on the videos, right? So I've seen Anthony talk through this video probably 30 times. So I'm getting off the flight, getting on the shuttle bus to go to the conference, and who gets on the bus? But there's Anthony Urquiza. And I was like, how do I introduce myself? I feel slightly like a stalker, you know, from Us Weekly or People Magazine, right? Because I know who he is from the videos. So I shuffle my way through. I find like an empty seat. I make sure I'm behind him. We have all our bags. And I manage to sit down sort of next to Anthony so that I can sort of, you know, my heart's beating, try to work up the nerve to say hello, because no one's in a great mood on a shuttle bus from the airport on the way to a conference, especially when you've flown across the country. I was coming from North Carolina, so not very far. But anyway, I managed to get to meet Anthony. Of course, he was incredibly gracious. We had a great conversation, and it's nice to be back. Being in a room full of PCIT therapists, I'm not going to be able to stop smiling. This is just an outstanding thing. I mean, I don't think for most treatments, it's hard enough to get a room full of people who believe in evidence-based treatment, much less one particular treatment that everyone's doing. This is really an awesome thing. And you know what? There's at least 100 more people who wanted to be in this room, but they had to turn it off. The numbers, you guys are the lucky few. You got the seats like the Grammys, the Emmys, that sort of thing. Because there's only room for so many. I was saying, I don't mind that it's a packed room because it just looks so full. You know, in the Grammys, when people get up, they have people come and sit in the empty seats. So we don't have to do that here because there's hardly even enough seats. So I'll be talking a little bit about PCIT, but as Anthony mentioned, mainly about trauma. So I do a lot of work both domestically and internationally with kids who've been impacted by trauma, with adults who've been impacted by trauma. And I think the more work that I do in the area of trauma, after this, you could almost just leave the talk, actually. This is the take-home. But please don't, even though the breakfast is good. Is what is the most important thing in the lives of children? Or one of the most important things? Their parents. Or whoever's playing that role as a caregiver. And so how could PCIT not be one of the most important things we could do for kids who've been through trauma if we support their parents? Because what do they need? What do most kids need? Sorry, this is not your usual plenary. You guys will have to talk some. And I realize it's before 9 a.m. I'll call on those with coffee in their hands. What do kids need?
Affection.
Affection. What else?
Safety.
Safety. Protection. What else? Nurturing. What else?
Consistency.
Attention. Praise. Reflections. Imitation. I'm glad you didn't go straight to that. So if that's what kids need, of course traumatized kids need that. And really with parenting, I felt like this was almost like my public service announcement single slide. It's so important for every part of development, right? And it's important for almost all kid outcomes. You can't really find in the literature a single outcome of importance where parenting isn't one of the things that's related to how we help kids succeed. When you think about school, when you think about mental health, when you think about growth, I mean, think even back to those early studies about the wire monkey that had food and the cloth monkey that had support that the little baby monkey could cuddle up to. It was all about the parent, right? Everything, whether it's growth, mental health, academic achievement. And parenting is everywhere, right? When I was preparing for this talk, I was just thinking about how important and how pervasive the focus on parenting is. There was even an article, you know, when I was putting this together on October 12th on Tuesday about helicopter parents and what impact helicopter anxious parents might have on freshmen entering college. So it's not just the young kids that we focus on for PCIT that need effective, loving parents that can offer all the things that you guys said, but it's all kids and it's across the lifespan. We still have needs for our parents. I don't think any of us want to do a child-directed interaction with the pride skills right now, but everybody has a need for support and for love and for effective parents. Is there anyone who'd like to do a child-directed interaction? Not so much. So what I want to talk about today, because everyone here is an expert in PCIT, is about just the prevalence of trauma, how it impacts kids, treatment options, obviously with a focus on parent-child interaction therapy, but a little discussion about trauma-focused cognitive behavioral therapy as well. And then really thinking about the role that parenting and family factors play in the role in the lives of children who've been traumatized and in symptoms. And then also, what's the role of PCIT? And the exciting thing is I get to basically just get the ball rolling this morning because there's so many great talks today and so much great discussion about PCIT with traumatized kids. So I'm hoping to just get you excited, get you thinking about things, and get to have some time together just really thinking about what else does PCIT offer for kids. So this is the sad slide, and that's that trauma is prevalent. And it's not just prevalent for kids in middle school, for kids in high school, and for adults. Young kids are incredibly exposed to traumatic events. I put references for all these in case anyone ever wants to go back and look at the papers. What I've got on here is some findings both from epidemiological studies. I love having to say like multiple syllable words when you're in front of a microphone and a podium. And then I've also got some studies where they just looked at exposure to trauma using thousands and thousands of calls, stratified, randomized. These are good data, and these kids are highly exposed. The Finkelhorst study just came out, and they look at kids across from about the youngest age here, around 2, all the way up to 18, and they look at last year exposure to violence and trauma, and they look at lifetime. And if you look across kids, about 80% of kids have had a past year exposure to some sort of violent or traumatic event. That's almost everybody. And then if you take the cross-section of kids that we see in mental health, given that we know most kids who need treatment don't actually make it into the treatment doors, that means we need to be asking about what? Trauma all the time. You know, juvenile justice is moving to this. Schools are becoming more trauma-informed. Child welfare, which deals with trauma all the time. Is anybody here from child welfare? Oh, yay. That makes me so happy. You're like, oh, come on. No, I'm just kidding. You know, child welfare, you guys have known this forever, right? I mean, trauma is such a prevalent part. Every kid that people deal with in child welfare are exposed to trauma. So we ought to be asking about it because it's everywhere. And sadly, the young kids are really keeping up. This is one place where we wish they weren't, right? But young kids, if you look in the yellow box, it's sort of hard to read from the slide from afar, but basically those are levels of any victimization, physical assault, witnessing violence, property violence. Before I looked at this table, I wouldn't have expected the young kids to be quite that high. And can young kids always report on their exposure to trauma? No. So we got to be asking who?
Parents.
And PCIT therapists are the best at getting who in the room? Parents. Absolutely. And caregivers and foster parents and aunts and grandmothers. When you have a young kid in treatment and the parent isn't seen, I'll play a clip from a foster parent talking about this in a little bit, we're really missing the boat. And the best thing about PCIT is it's a model that's designed to have that parent in the room, to have them be an integral part of treatment, to have them be the answer, right, to helping the child. And the best thing about that is if we need to know about trauma, you've got somebody in there to help you figure out what the kid has been through. But we'll never know if we don't ask. So one of the things that I want to just bring home today is just the importance of always asking about trauma exposure for all the children that you see. Even if you don't end up doing a trauma-focused treatment, knowing about exposure helps us be more successful. And it doesn't have to be any kind of fancy measure. There are lots of measures out there that list traumatic events that you can use, but finding out about trauma exposure is just a list. So you can even just have your own list. Or you can use something like the UCLA PTSDRI, the first page has a trauma screen. Lots of good things come from California. So what about the parents? Do you think our parents have been through trauma? Absolutely. How do you think that impacts their ability to parent, to give affection, stability, love, caring? Do you guys see times when that's challenging for parents because of their own experiences? Have you seen parents who may have PTSD symptoms, not only because what they've been through, but what their children have been through? And that is incredibly common. And so all this, of course, is building to this large crescendo of, if kids have trauma symptoms, if parents have trauma symptoms, one of the ways to help everybody get back on track is to be able to do what you guys are already doing, which is to help them enhance parenting, enhance the parent-child relationship, and enhance the way the family's functioning. Now, when you think a little bit about how trauma exposure impacts kids, part of this I know you already know because you're seeing it in the kids that you serve every day. One of the most common ways that we think about how trauma impacts kids is post-traumatic stress disorder, right? And I think when most people think about PTSD, we think more about the adult version, how it impacts soldiers, how it impacts rape victims. What's interesting, as I'm sure you've seen a lot of this, is that there are moves to better specify PTSD for young children, and that their symptoms, if you look in the DSM on the page for at least three things, it says, note, in young children it may look like this. Note, in young children it may look like this. But yet, in the community, I think people are holding to sort of the adult version of PTSD and what it looks like, and you're not always going to see that in kids. So just looking to the DSM just as a starting place, we have lots of seats up here if you guys want to come sit up here. I hate for people to be hanging out in the back. So if you think about it, I mean, obviously kids have to have exposure to a traumatic event, or anyone does, and that we find out by asking. And then there's at least one symptom of re-experiencing. And usually with adults, it's that they're having memories about the traumatic event, they're having intrusive thoughts where they're having flashbacks or thoughts back to what happened, physiological distress, so body's feeling really keyed up, intense psychological distress, symptoms of avoidance, right? So people are avoiding places, things, and thoughts and feelings that remind them of what happened. And then increased arousal, or sort of that hypervigilance where your body is really keyed up because you're kind of on fight or flight all the time. And it's symptom duration more than a month that it causes clinically significant distress or impairment. So that's the DSM that we all know. What's interesting is that for a while people weren't even sure, not now, but historically people weren't even sure if young kids could develop post-traumatic stress disorder. But what we know now is that classic triad of re-experiencing, avoidance, and increased arousal, you can see it, but it looks a little different because kids developmentally at a young age are quite different than adults. And it's definitely harder to see in pre-verbal children. And I think if you go from thinking about pre-verbal children, kind of infants, all the way up to adults, as kids get older, obviously it starts to look a lot more like the classic PTSD that you might see with a rape victim or a veteran. But when kids are younger, there's a lot more focus on figuring out if the kid is having trauma symptoms by looking at things that you can observe behaviorally. So is the kid, recreating what happened to them through traumatic play? Are they, engaging in doing various things in their play where you can see some of what they've been through? And then often they're having nightmares. Now, as therapists, we can't see that, but parents can report that the kid is waking up a lot and they're having nightmares. And interestingly, for little kids, the nightmares don't have to be about the traumatic event. Kids who've been traumatized have a higher prevalence of nightmares in general, even if the content isn't specific to what happened. And then they're also a lot more likely, if you look at the DC 0-3 manual, they're also a lot more likely to have some symptoms that are developmentally sensitive to how old they are and make a lot of sense, like new separation anxiety. How many of you have seen that? A kid who has something traumatic or bad happen to them, and now they can't separate from their caregiver. We have a kid in my TFCBT study right now that he lives with his grandmother after a lot of trauma, living with his mom. He would be sitting on her shoulder if he could. I mean, it's hard almost to get him. Anytime his grandmother's around, he's wrapped around her arm, he's wrapped around her body, wrapped around his leg. He has so much trouble separating from her, and all of that is part of his need to what? He feels safe when he's with her, and if she's out of the room, he feels very unsafe. But what's that going to get in the way of? Going to school. Exactly, going to Boy Scouts. They just started school, and because that is sort of forced exposure, he's actually doing a little better because he's getting to practice being away from her and see that he's still safe at school away from her. But it makes so much sense that you'd see a lot of this separation anxiety in young kids when they've been exposed to trauma. And you also see a lot of new fears unrelated to the trauma, as well as kids who've lost some previously acquired skills. So maybe they were toilet trained before and now they're having trouble. They were better able to regulate and do various things and now they've regressed slightly. Are these things that you guys see? Good, I'm not completely off track. No one's left yet. So the other thing we like to think about a lot is like how common is PTSD? Because honestly, it's actually slightly less common than people would think. And in kids, it's slightly less common because kids respond to trauma in so many ways that PTSD is not necessarily the most common diagnosis for kids who've been traumatized. But we think about, when you think about people that are exposed to trauma, about 20% of women have PTSD, about 8% of exposed men, so higher rates for women. Relatively similar rates from EPI studies for children and adolescents. But there are populations that have extremely high risk. So around veterans, about 1 in 5 will have a diagnosis of PTSD. Kids in foster care, a particular focus of mine, have rates of PTSD equivalent to veterans, and veterans have the highest rate of almost any population. Rape victims would be up here as well. And there's some new findings coming out just this last year that back up some early work that alumni of foster care have high rates of PTSD. And now there's some new work by Mark Courtney with huge samples showing that adults who are alumni of foster care are more likely to have PTSD and alcohol and substance use disorders. And again, a lot of that comes back to early exposure to what? An inconsistent what? Yes. All right. So everything that we're doing is designed to start thinking about, have kids been traumatized? How do we help them out? And how do we prevent some of these outcomes? What we don't have are EPI studies looking at how prevalent is PTSD in young children. And so some people have thought that maybe it's higher in young kids because of their developmental age, their developmental level. Maybe it's lower. We don't really know. So how often in your setting do you see sort of this classic triad of symptoms when you see kids that they're re-experiencing what happened through play, they're avoiding situations, and that they sort of have that revved up kind of hyper-arousal, almost attention-looking difficulties? Would you say all the time? Great. Well, then we're all in the right place. And I'm actually really looking forward to not just being with you now, but to all the talks the rest of the day. I think we're doing what needs to be done, right? This needs to happen for kids across the country. We need to figure out how to help traumatized kids and how to look at a lot of different ways to serve traumatized kids. So how many people have heard of trauma-focused cognitive behavioral therapy? Wow, I should take a picture of that. Judy, Tony, and Esther would love that. So TFCBT is a fabulous treatment. I'm doing work in Tanzania with TFCBT with kids who've been orphaned by the AIDS epidemic. We're doing lots of work in Washington, in California, through UC Davis. Statewide, we're in about 7 to 8 countries, low-resource settings right now, doing TFCBT. And as you guys know, it's a cognitive behavioral treatment for kids between 3 and 17. We currently have 9 randomized trials. I have a study with kids in foster care, which should be completed soon, making 10. And it's a short-term treatment It's a short-term treatment like PCIT, right? So we have great data from TFCBT that improves PTSD, depression, shame, mild behavior problems, sexual abuse-related behaviors. But we don't have a lot of data with TFCBT for kids with serious behavior problems for which PCIT was developed for. In my foster care study, we're doing TFCBT just as it's written, but parenting is one of the first components that you do in TFCBT. It's a practice acronym, and the first P is psychoeducation. The second P, there's two Ps, is parenting. And with foster care, I call that a really big P. So we do a lot of parenting in my TFCBT study for kids in foster care, because what gets kids kicked out of foster homes? Behavior problems, not being sad and depressed and worried. It's, you know, tearing down the drapes, spreading feces, running away, hitting, yelling. So we're doing a lot of parenting, very specific to behavior problems. But what I think is interesting, if you look at TFCBT, if you look at some of the other treatments for child trauma in young children, child-parent psychotherapy, there is always a parent component. If you look at the evidence-based treatments for PTSD in young kids, there is always a parent involved. And again, it's just because parenting, when you think about young kids, there's only, how many of you have kids between 2 and 7, actually? How much do they retain week to week? If you tell them something on Monday, do they remember it the next Monday? You're like, no, they do not. So in some ways, it makes so much sense that any treatment of trauma would have to involve the parent, because if you do one-on-one therapy, and there's certainly lots of people out there doing some one-on-one work with kids, and many of those approaches have yet to be studied or maybe being studied, but my best bet is always that you need the parent, because for the very reason that even our own kids who are taught skills, maybe to calm down, to regulate on a Monday, aren't going to necessarily retain those until the following Monday if we don't have someone who lives in the home with them, reminding them to use them, praising them, supporting them, and helping them. And in my foster care study, the whole emphasis is on engaging the foster parent, because so many kids in foster care get dropped off and get one-on-one therapy if they're not getting something like PCIT. And these are kids who have really high levels of dysregulation, inconsistent parenting and caregiving, as we've talked about, high levels of trauma symptoms. So we really need the person who's in the home with them right now, and then later the bio parent, to be helping them out through doing effective parenting, effective discipline, effective limit setting, and support, praise, love, and all those things that you guys mentioned. Now, is trauma exposure the only thing, typical trauma symptoms, PTSD, is that all that you see in the young kids exposed to trauma in your settings? What else do you see? Oh, so you see some of that honeymoon behaving perfectly to try to, almost to try to, if I, the overachiever, almost to, if I could just behave and do the right thing, I can get the love or something like that. What else do you see? Insecure attachment. What else? Oppositional behavior, for sure. Sexualized behavior. What else? What'd you say? Yeah, and anxiety, exactly. And so, you know, one of the reasons that I think PCIT holds so much promise, and let's take a look at this list, is that it's not just PTSD that impacts young traumatized kids. Their symptoms are a lot broader, they span a much wider range, and a lot of them are directly targeted by parenting. So this is from the NCTSN website. They have a nice section on information about how trauma impacts young kids, because it is challenging. And in some ways, can you imagine showing this to a caregiver of a young traumatized kid who can't figure out what's going on with their child? Just showing that this is the range of symptoms, because this would really normalize it and help them understand some of the interventions that we do. So just take a look at that. I'll stop talking a second and let you take a look at some of those. A lot of what you guys said are on this list. And I see people trying to look at their slides almost with a magnifying glass. So if you're really interested, this is it's a messy web link, but this is the exact link to it. But you can also search for trauma and young children on the NCTSN website. So given that wide range of possible interactions, we really need a range of treatment approaches with an ability to focus on what is the one thing or one or two things that's most impairing for the child, that's the primary treatment need, and the primary symptom or difficulty that the kid's having, because our whole task is to try to get kids back on track developmentally. We want them to be able to focus on playing. We want them to be able to focus on school. We want them to be able to play with their siblings and not have nightmares and sleep at night. What do sleep problems do for kids? I mean, it is a huge problem. I mean, one of the first things I'll do with kids who've been traumatized if I'm doing TFCBT is help the caregiver get a sleep hygiene routine for kids, because when kids don't sleep, they can't pay attention at school, they can't run at soccer, they're short and more irritable with the other kids in the household, they don't listen as well, they have trouble with concentration. So, you know, we really need a range of approaches that can deal with a lot of these things. And sometimes the primary impairment is PTSD. Sometimes it's more behavioral or affective dysregulation, and sometimes one of the primary difficulties of the kid is just that you're seeing a lot of parenting deficits, and it really seems like we could help get the kid on track by working directly on parenting and doing that parent-mediated parent-mediated intervention, which is what we do with PCIT. Has anybody ever done sequencing of approaches when you think about kids with lots of symptoms? So one of the things I know they're doing a lot of at UC Davis and really thinking about, and I think a lot of the other of us around the country, are also thinking about what might you do if you have a kid who has primary PTSD symptoms as well as maybe a behavior problem. Often we want a sequence. They've done some studies looking at is more. So, you know, if kids got PTSD, behavior problems, school problems, do you put in a tutor? Do you do PCIT? Do you do TF-CBT? And do you put the parent in a substance abuse class? And do you think that's more? It's too much more, right? So what they found with some of sort of the kitchen sink approaches is families and kids don't really know where to focus and to put their attention and their efforts. And so possibly a sequencing approach is more effective so that they can focus on one thing, have some success, finish that, and move to the next thing. And the other reason is because we're really trying to help kids and families get back to some sense of normal. And if every day after school you have to go to therapy or counseling appointments, it's really hard to start getting back to normal. You can't play in your yard. You can't take some kind of lesson. We know that not all kids get to take a music lesson or a sports lesson. But when they do, we know that's really good for kids. And if they, like I had a kid today, I got an email about a kid in my study who finished his trauma narrative. The parents decided to take him to soccer instead of having him finish treatment. And I'm really sad because my study would be a lot better if he'd just do those last four sessions. But I actually support that. He finished his trauma narrative. His symptoms are down. And honestly, I think for this kid, soccer is probably a better next component of treatment than anything else they could do. It just makes it hard for my study. But for the kid, it's really great. And that's what we want kids to get back to doing. So sometimes a sequencing approach can be effective. Also, as Anthony's going to present some data later, PCIT actually is getting some really nice outcomes for improving PTSD symptoms and trauma symptoms. And so if potentially the main issue is behavioral or even if it's PTSD and we think PCIT is the way to start, if we reassess and the kid is better, they could stop then. And so this argues, again, not just for asking about trauma symptoms and assessing that early on, but also assessing symptoms in kids at the beginning, in the middle, as you complete kind of modules or components of treatment, because we only need to give kids as much as they need to get better. And there's a lot of move in the adult literature to really do more regular symptom monitoring so that we can really see if kids are better and be done. So if we assess a kid at the end of PCIT or at the end of TF-CBT and they're doing well, then the kid could be done. And that's the best thing about PCIT is you guys are assessing every week. You're coding before you do anything. It makes a decision about how you conduct that session. And that is an amazingly effective way to do things. And other models are trying to move to that, but it's built into PCIT. Now, was PCIT designed to treat trauma? No. It's one of the best interventions, probably the intervention with the most evidence for treating behavior problems in kids that are young. And we have Bart Chaffin's data and Beth Funderburk's data on looking at PCIT to change physically maltreating behavior, right? It reduced physical maltreatment by 50% in the 2004 study. Now, it wasn't designed to prevent physical abuse, was it? But they looked to the literature, and if you talk to Mark about it, he just said, why would we make up something new? If we have a great intervention that works and it has great effect sizes, why don't we pull from what's already worked, what has great literature, great research, and bring that into other settings? And the interesting thing is that's exactly where we are for trauma in PCIT. We are on the cusp of trying an amazing, wonderful intervention and seeing what the possibility and promise and impact it has on another set of symptoms like PTSD. And that's a really exciting place, I think, to be in the field, because then you don't have to, this whole room doesn't have to go out and learn an entirely new intervention to treat a separate set of symptoms. We're looking at, can this intervention that we do well, that's widely disseminated in California and nationwide, work for trauma symptoms? And it makes a lot of sense because we're teaching parents skills to improve their relationship with their children so they can offer more support. And we're teaching them positive parenting and appropriate and safe discipline skills to deal with some of the behavioral dysregulation and various behavioral symptoms that you guys mentioned. Now, when we looked at that range of symptoms, and I'm going to put it back up again so you don't have to just read off your miniature slide, But did you see any areas for the young kids, the symptoms about for kids impacted by trauma, where PCIT could play a role? What do you think? I'll put it back up in just a second, but did you see some? So I think one of the best and most obvious ways that it plays a really clear role is the fact that in community mental health settings, what is the primary referral reason for children to community mental health? Behavior problems, right? That is the main reason that kids end up in treatment. So if you start with that group, PCIT makes so much sense. When you start assessing for trauma, then we find out which kids in that group have been exposed to trauma, and then we start seeing that overlap that you guys were mentioning earlier, that kids have behavioral problems, affective dysregulation, and then they also have the classic triad of PTSD symptoms, in addition to more general fear, avoidance, and nightmares, and so PCIT makes a lot of sense. So which of these do you think gets addressed either directly with CDI or indirectly with CDI? What'd you say? Most of them. That's cheating. But it's true, right? A lot of them. When you think about scream or cry excessively, act out in socials, well, sorry, I'm skipping ahead actually a little to PDI, but we start getting good outcomes in CDI for improvement on some of these things right away, right? But certainly demand attention through both positive and negative behaviors. What are we helping kids learn in CDI right away? How to get attention. Yeah, and exhibit the positive and you get the praise, the reflections. Thinking specifically about PDI, some of them I just said a second ago, but think about if a lot of these fall under the behavioral dysregulation, acting out, PDI directly targets so many of these. And then if you look at the literature on PCIT, it's almost like a really targeted thing that then goes out into concentric circles, because you see in the literature that when we directly target behavioral dysregulation, we get some improvement in self-esteem, we get some improvement in depression, we get improvement in other settings. And so some of these we directly target with CDI and PDI, but most of them are all linked to what it is that we're doing in CDI and PDI. So if we teach parents to do better management of inappropriate behavior, and we teach them to offer praise and positive support, that tends to trickle down to a lot of the other outcomes that you have on here. And so when I think about PCIT in young traumatized kids, it seems like it is absolutely indicated for kids who have behavior problems. It's probably the first place I would go. Because what's the other positive benefit of effective parent training programs that we see for parents? It reduces their stress, and we've got outcomes that improves their depression. And we know the literature on parental depression being difficult for parents to handle children who are acting out, and for parents to be more irritable, more short-tempered, and more both coercive in the way that they interact with kids. So improving parental depression is a huge deal. And a lot of parents whose kids have been traumatized and who've been through trauma themselves, they have a lot of depression along with PTSD symptoms. So PCIT also can reduce their stress, their depression, and help them function better for parents. Now, when you think about kids without behavior problems who have trauma symptoms, we've talked about it a little bit, but is anybody thinking specifically with your experience in PCIT how it might be helpful? Does anybody have an example from a case? Absolutely. And how supportive, you know, parents whose kids have been traumatized often feel very downtrodden, very much like there's nothing they can do. And even foster parents feel incredibly overwhelmed. And so when you think about a particular parenting approach that also offers the coaching and the support and the new skills that PCIT does, it just holds a lot of promise just for lifting that feeling that there's not much that can change. Because parents get such direct support in how to do these new skills with their kids. Now, what aspect of traditional trauma treatment is PCIT missing? For those, so many people know TFCBT. What are we missing here? The narrative, exactly. Does someone want to describe what the narrative is? What did you say? So the trauma narrative is when the kids tell their story of what happened, right? So they talk about the traumatic event, they draw a picture of it, and it's one of the best ways to get rid of avoidance. So I think if we have kids with really high avoidance, and we think and really high re-experiencing, so lots of nightmares, generalized fears, thinking about what happened. If we take the PCIT approach and we assess at the end and those symptoms haven't improved, we can do the aspects of TFCBT that they're missing, which would be practice, but you've got a strong foundation in parenting. Or if you think the hypervigilance and the re-experiencing and the avoidance are the predominant primary symptoms, we can start with TFCBT and then come back to PCIT. So you've got the sequencing option and assessing all along the way to figure out where the kid is and what would be the best next thing to do and if the kid needs anything additional. But the key with PCIT is, as we started talking about at the beginning today, that improving parenting, the parent-child relationship, family functioning, if you look at the literature, in many ways is really almost a cure for anything with kids. Anytime we better support parents, anytime we better support the way the family is operating, kids do better. So here are some of the things, if you look to the literature, about what are some of the family factors that make it more difficult for kids to move forward, to advance, and to sort of heal and recover from trauma. These are the things that tend to be related to worse outcomes. So family conflict, family chaos, parental mental health problems, anxiety, depression, post-traumatic stress disorder, parental rejection of the child, and when parents induce guilt, not guild. They've got little guilds going. When they induce guilt and anxiety in the child, that relates to worse outcomes. Low parental support, that's a huge one with TFCBT. A lot of what we're doing is helping parents become more supportive of the child, both in general and related to the traumatic experience. There's a lot of data for that being problematic. And then also parental withdrawal and irritability with the family. What are you doing with PCIT? Working on a lot of these, right? The very first thing we do is start teaching parents how to better support their kids, how to give them love, how to give them praise, how to give them attention. And if withdrawal is a problem, when families start doing special time every day, you are building in that one-on-one time with the kid, which starts making kids feel loved and supported. And that maybe they aren't the reason everything happened, or they aren't to blame, or horrible kids because of what happened. Because so many kids, no matter what age, they always think whatever, they have that magical thinking, right? So whatever happened, they almost always think it's their fault. And by seeing that the parent is not withdrawing from them, is spending time with them, giving them all the pride skills and special time, it's a big part of getting at some of these issues around withdrawal, support, rejection. And then, do you think that getting a 2 to 7-year-old with behavior problems to behave better impacts family conflict and chaos? Absolutely. And how many of you have seen your parents, and we know this from the literature, but how many of you have seen the parents start applying those skills to other kids in the household? And age them up. I mean, I've had parents where I'm like, wow, they are figuring out how to use these skills with a 14-year-old, the 15-year-old, which really does start to reduce that chaos and then also the conflict. So, of course, it's really just the other side of the coin, but the factors that are related to kids having better outcomes following trauma are parental functioning, positive parenting, the parent's response to the event. Can they talk to the child about it openly? Can they be supportive to the child about what happened? And then also their ability to support the child, as I said before, both generally and then also related to trauma. So again, PCIT is such a nice fit when you think about the literature and what the factors are related to better and worse outcomes. So this is from the NCTSN site as well, and I just thought it's such a great quote to think about the role of parents. Young children depend exclusively on parents or caregivers for survival and protection, both physical and emotional. When trauma also impacts the parent or caregiver, the relationship between that person and the child may be strongly affected. Without the support of a trusted parent or caregiver to help them regulate their strong emotions, children may experience overwhelming stress with little ability to effectively communicate what they feel or need. And that's one of the biggest issues for the young kids, right? They can't always tell us in words, like adults do, what their symptoms are, what their struggles are. So we're teaching parents to provide that support and that love, even if the kid isn't always saying it. Children often develop symptoms that parents or caregivers don't understand and may display uncharacteristic behaviors that adults may not know how to appropriately respond to. And so with PCIT, we're trying to help the parents give that skill, because we're not there all the time. So when you think about traumatized kids, ideally we want someone in the home 24/7 who's able to do the things to support the child to help them regulate. I always feel like cognitive behavioral therapy approaches are so akin to this analogy that we've all heard a million times. But you know that analogy, you can teach a man to fish and he can eat for a day. I mean, you can give a man a fish and he can eat for a day, or you can teach a man to fish and he can eat for a lifetime. That's what we do with cognitive behavioral therapy approaches. That's what we do with PCIT, is give this parent these skills to support kids who are traumatized, who are having nightmares, who are having behavioral dysregulation, so they can support the child in the room the whole time and at home before bedtime when all of us aren't around. And parent involvement is just so crucial. And in PCIT, we're involving them, but in a lot of cases, they're not. I want to play just a clip from a foster parent. She's talking about TFCBT, a parent from my study, but she lays out so clearly why if we don't have parents involved, we can't support children and we can't really help them in the most effective way possible. But yet that happens a lot out there in settings, but not with folks in this room, so it really reinforces what you're doing. And I'm just going to keep my fingers crossed that it actually plays.
This is my seventh year as a foster parent. I've always said, how come I don't get to be a part of this? That's been so frustrating. Mm-hmm. And so I jumped on it when I got to be. I was just shocked and floored and excited and blown away and looking forward to it so much. A lot for my own personal growth. Because if I can gain skills, it doesn't just apply to Alyssa and Mishaya. And I have kids for a day to 6 months.
Yes.
And I have a lot of children come and go. And being a therapeutic home, the more skills, the better. So, I don't want to be left out. I want to know what's going on with those kids. Mm-hmm. In the therapies we've done before, they wouldn't tell me one thing. Mm-hmm. That's not helpful. Mm-hmm. The kids go through stuff, they come home, they're acting out, and I don't know why or how come or what's going on.
Yes.
That's really, really, really hard.
Yes.
And especially when they're not my kids, and I don't know what happened to them when they were three and that would cause that reaction. Or,
yes.
So I don't know how to help them.
Yes.
It also sometimes flips me out and makes me really angry or frustrated or want to withdraw or whatever. Mm-hmm. Because I don't have that information. And so not only are the kids, but then there's my part too.
Yes.
And that isn't helpful at all.
Mm-hmm. Am I? Absolutely, making perfect sense.
So I'd like to be part of the team. Our agency says we're a team, but it's not true. Mm-hmm. The kids and the staff, they're a team, and the foster parents are just out in left field.
Mm-hmm.
Totally. Mm-hmm. It's like a three-legged stool and we keep falling over.
Yes.
You know, which is, and I've been struggling with that for 7 years because I don't understand that. Mm-hmm. It makes no sense to me at all that the primary caretaker 24 hours a day isn't included.
Mm-hmm.
And I've never understood how come the staff, the therapists, can know so much when they don't even talk to us, when we're not involved.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't make sense to me, yes.
What do you think? It's pretty powerful. And PCIT is the opposite of that, right? You're with the parent way more than you're with the kid, and they are part of the solution, and they are part of figuring out 24/7 how to help these kids, how to support these kids. Did anything strike you listening to what she said, thinking about the work that we do with PCIT?
Just about her wanting to have the skills, and that's exactly what we
do. Absolutely. And it's also exactly what, and I was actually looking at some of the slides for the future talks, that with foster parents especially, teaching them skills to help one or two kids, that's going to help all the kids that come through their home. And how many of you see kids in foster care in your settings? I figured a lot. And so in many ways, when we do PCIT with a foster parent to help a child, we're not just helping that kid, but we're helping every kid that comes through that home. As this mom said, she has kids from 6 weeks to 6 months, I think she said, because she was more of a short-term placement. But so she's having a lot of kids who go through her home before they go to the next setting. And anytime we're raising the skill of one parent that has a lot of kids in the home, we're raising all boats. because every kid that comes through is hopefully going to benefit from those skills. So again, when you're thinking about trauma, the one thing I want to note too is that to hear what she said, that sometimes she doesn't even know what the kids have been through. One of the best things you can do for foster parents specifically is not just teach them behavior management skills, a program like PCIT, but screen the kid for trauma, find out from the caseworker, help the foster parent figure out what the kids have been through. Because I keep hearing that in studies on therapeutic foster care that we've done and foster care, that parents have no idea what has happened to their kids, and they're often scared to ask. And we've actually learned that asking doesn't hurt kids. There have been studies studying asking, right? And kids actually do okay. We ask kids and we ask parents in my study in the home what they've been through. And we start at 7, so we don't ask a lot of the younger kids that are in the PCIT range, but the child welfare workers for the cases are great resources for what kids have been through when you're thinking about screening kids, figuring out the best approach, and then making sure that it's trauma-informed, whether it's PCIT, trauma-focused CBT, but we know the kid's trauma history. So screening for trauma is incredibly important. And remember, when you're thinking about how it impacts kids, there's such a broad range that if you do wide measurement, if you're doing the ECBE, if you also do a PTSD measure, those could be a great way to try to figure out what the symptoms are. And there's some great measures for young kids to look at trauma symptoms. And PCIT, like other treatments for young trauma, actively involves the parent, and that's a really key thing. Anytime we're working with young kids who are traumatized, the parent really has to be actively involved. And the best part about PCIT is that we're already doing it. It's built into the model. When you've got kids who have PTSD, and especially if they're in foster care, if they have behavioral problems, PCIT would absolutely be indicated. When I'm doing trauma-focused CBT, if a kid has a behavior problem that I think threatens the placement, all of our focus is on behavior first. Because every move for a kid is hard. Every single move. We create behavior problems, actually. They've untangled behavior problems compared to moves. And behavior problems cause moves, but moves cause behavior problems, too. So anytime you've got a kid where behavior problem is the issue, whether it's a bio home, an adoptive home, or a foster home, I would really seriously consider PCIT as a frontline treatment because you can really target those behavior problems immediately and let the parents see some success and some hope, even if you think later you might do a more PTSD symptom-oriented treatment. Also, as Anthony's going to talk about in a little bit, we've got some data that PCIT, relatively standardly delivered, impacts PTSD symptoms already. So there's a great chance that by directly targeting those behavior problems that are frustrating the parent, potentially disrupting the placement, that you're at the same time getting at PTSD symptoms in an effective way. And the best way you know is to assess, right, before and assess after. And as PCIT folks, everybody's used to doing that. We do a lot of assessment. The other thing is just to remember that the sequencing is an option. And also just that the best thing about treating trauma with PCIT is you are using one of the most effective treatments for kids out there. And that is a really wonderful thing because there's a lot out there that's not that effective. And so in situations where people aren't sure what to do, I'd always go with something that has good outcomes before I'd try anything else because there's a really good chance the kid's going to improve. And as you're assessing, you can figure out before you go the next way. We're doing a lot of work right now with APSAC, if people know APSAC, American Professional Society for the Abuse of Children. Is that right? I hate acronyms. And what we're working on is a set of guidelines for evidence-based case planning in child welfare with one of the first points that any time you can, go to an evidence-based treatment first because at least we know it impacts one or two things effectively before we end up doing something more generally. Now, the best thing about today, like I said, is I just get to kick off all the coming attractions for the rest of the day. So we're going to get to hear a lot about child trauma and the effectiveness of PCIT, looking at some actual data. And there's a talk specifically on some of what I was mentioning, which is making decisions about sequencing. What's the best modality for treatment in the context of child trauma? How do you make those decisions? Because how many people in here are trained in TFCBT? See, you have a lot of choices That's the best part. You can think about PCIT, you can think about TFCBT, because we've got a group who's largely trained in both models. And then also coming soon is a web course for PCIT being developed by the UC Davis folks that will offer a wonderful resource that you'll hear about today in addition to the TFCBT web course. So we're going to have a lot broader options as you make new hires and as people come onto your teams and as people need refresher courses. Because the more we learn about dissemination and implementation is that we all need refreshers, even experts. And so having a web-based way to do that is really outstanding. But then just a couple things to keep in mind to sort of finish in some ways where we started. Just as you hear about the talks today and as you think about your own practice of PCIT with kids who've been traumatized, just keep in mind the major needs of all children and the needs of traumatized children and just the incredibly critical role of parenting and all that you're doing to support parents, child outcomes, family functioning, and kids getting back on track. Thank you for all that you do. Have any questions, comments? Yes.
I agree with what you're saying about the involvement of the special effort and things that people have. What do you do if your parents are not emotionally available to do the work that is required?
That's a great question. So what do you do when parents aren't emotionally available or able to do the work that's required? The nice thing is there'll be a talk later on engaging caregivers, which I think will be really helpful. But a lot of what we're doing in my study and in other approaches in Washington is we're doing it first assessing, figuring out why. Is it their own PTSD? Is it their own depression? Or is it just a disinterest in participating in therapy actively? Or is it watching TV and seeing that therapy is a kid? You just, the dentist model, right? You just drop a kid off. So trying to figure out some of those things. If it's PTSD, then sometimes it seems like they might need some of their own treatment to manage that first. But again, it's a short-term treatment. But then we've also been doing a lot of motivational interviewing with parents to try to build that if they're sort of ambivalent about interest participating in change, but really looking at some of trying to build their motivation to engage. And there's been some great data for that with Mark Chaffin's latest study on PCIT, where they really studied the active engagement and MI strategies to try to get families involved. But I think what you're bringing up is the heart of it. Yes, we need parents, but they're not always that easy to engage. Where in my study, we're doing a lot of Mary McKay's work, if people have seen Mary McKay's work, where she talks a lot about the biggest barrier to treatment is not childcare. It's actually not transportation, because families that have trouble with that negotiate that every day if it's important, but it's stigma around mental health and perception that it won't be helpful, either from past experiences or what you've seen on TV. And so we do a lot of her work, which involves from the very beginning talking a lot about what are your past experiences, have been helpful or unhelpful, and explaining a lot about how different this is, and then it's short term and all those kind of things, but really discussing past experiences. And making sure that the intake is clinically helpful versus just paperwork. She focuses a lot on that also. She says your goal of a first session is to have a second session. And there's not, and for parents, I need to finish my intake paperwork is not a good enough reason for a second session. So she always starts something active in the very first session so people have had the conversation about their past experiences, how they were helpful or not, and how this is different. And then in the first session, something happens that is clinically helpful to move forward. And states aren't helping us with this because they keep lumping on more and more paperwork to provide treatment. But, you know, when possible, doing that at the beginning. Yeah?
I was just wondering, would you ever, if you see both the behavioral challenges and the parenting issues as well as the significant trauma issues for a child with a parent and child children, and the relationship between parenting and parenting work, but the child also has this significant individual mental health and trauma focus needs? I think the idea of sequencing is great. I know at our agency,
right.
Does it make sense to do both before the both, and you can start both together, or is that not okay?
There's a talk, is it two talks from now? Or we have a talk exactly on that today, but I think where you are exactly where a lot of us are, and we have some suggestions and answers, but we haven't done the studies to see which makes sense. So I think it varies. Oh, use the microphone. Oops. Sorry. So I think we're doing this. No one's done the study, so I think it's all about the careful assessment, primary need, and consultation with colleagues. But they're going to talk about that a little bit today, because that's absolutely the question, I think. All right, I'll turn it back over to you.
We're going to take a break in a minute, but I have two things to say. One is, thank you, Dr. Dorsey, for a wonderful presentation. The second is, I think you now appreciate why I was very interested in having Dr. Dorsey talk today, because she's very knowledgeable. She has knowledge not just as you're listening to her talk about PCIT and about what it is, but she also has this other knowledge about trauma, and she's just very informed. So I learned a lot in listening to her, and I